This is John Lebkowski of Plutopia Productions. I'm here with Scoop Sweeney. This is 20 Minutes into the Future, a production of the Plutopia News Network. You want to say hello, Scoop?
Hello, Scoop. And actually, it's only 19 minutes into the future. It's a Sunday, and I'm running a little late.
Yeah, we always count down, right? We're very happy to welcome as today's guest, Dave Damaris, who is more than a friend of Plutopia. He produced the seminal Plutopia event, which was called the DIY Home of the Future at Austin's Maker Faire. And he came up with the name Plutopia in a discussion following that event. David is currently working at IBM Microelectronics, working on pattern recognition applications in VLSI design. And that is like mini transistors on a chip. He has a PhD in computer engineering, and in his doctoral research, Dave focused on nonlinear dynamics and oscillation phenomena in networks, which had applications to signal processing, pattern recognition, perceptual and cognitive modeling. He's also into scientific visualization, user interface design, usability, adaptive design methods, algorithmic composition techniques in music and visual arts, and a whole range of other interests. This is going to be a great conversation today. David's also a musician, one of the finest and most diverse DJs in Austin, working as Dr. Strange Vibe, and he's going to be appearing later this week at the Cohabitat Party. That's on March 10th of 2011, which is a sort of pre-South by Southwest local party. David, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, John. Thanks for asking. And, you know, I guess I could just say that to some extent, I have to thank you for my emerging DJ career, because I think you're the first person that recommended me a few years ago to Salona for an event. And, you know, since then, the word's kind of spreading around. And I was, you know, one of these guys that, I guess, having sort of grown up in the 70s and the anti-disco era, and sort of watching the rise of DJ culture and kind of going, no, this is all wrong. You know, I resisted this DJ identity, but I got over it pretty quick because I enjoyed doing it. And I think, you know, people appreciate having, someone that's a musician that, you know, has that kind of attitude and make sure that the beats that are there are interesting. So...
Well, you always DJed all the, the EFF Austin parties at South by Southwest Interactive.
Yeah, some of those were actually when I was, you know, doing laptop solo works. And it wasn't exactly DJing, but, you know, more like live electronics using probably mostly Ableton Live. And some of it could have been a little bit, you know, DJ-esque, but it was mostly me playing back things that I had already produced, you know, so maybe some of the things would be more or less hands-on and others would be a little bit more, playing a piece that I had already done, which is sort of the old school way that electronic musicians, you know, worked prior to all this nice interactive live stuff that we have today. I think there were a couple where it really was a little bit more like live mixing with some music that you might have recognized. Like, I think I used a groove from Talking Heads' Remain in Light and then threw some other stuff over the top of that. And, so I guess I was sort of making the transition on my own.
Well, when you and I first met about 20 years ago, I think around that time or soon after we met, you had a jazz band called Alien Dreamtime.
It was Alien Time Ensemble.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are you still playing jazz?
I guess I am on occasion. I haven't gigged with that group for a couple, maybe 3 years now or so, but, still doing a little bit of jamming and recording in my house and playing the piano quite a bit. I think... in the last year or two, as I think you know, I was doing some kind of extended international work assignments and kind of put a lot of the continuity that was required for being in a band or something. I just kind of put that stuff on hold and focused more on solo recording, and generally I've been working very, very hard on some of the electronic stuff in the last year or so, and DJing is a little less time intensive and works out pretty well. If you're
you mentioned that you had problems with the standard DJ image. What was it about that you didn't particularly like? How is your approach different?
Well, I think it was just in general, live musicians kind of resented the the sort of taking the airtime that you felt like the skill level and I mean, I'd always sort of respected the sort of the best DJs for at least being good curators and taking the time to find stuff, but that's still a minority. So I think it was just generally saying, well, we know that these guys are going out and getting paid as much as or more as musicians, and they just really haven't put in the woodshed time, And particularly when you're in, a jazz musician, and you really you have to do that. What is it, the 10,000 hours kind of thing to really become an expert? And it's just, in general, John, this actually, I think I dropped you a couple of words that would appear in my personal cloud tag, like logical debt. So that's actually a term from computer science. When people were thinking about how to describe the complexity of objects, and there was, a couple of ideas I think floated in the 60s. One is this idea in this kind of algorithmic information theory, the idea that the complexity of an object was the length of the smallest program that could generate that object. And then that was kind of improved a few years later by another IBM guy, Charles Bennett, and independently conceived in Russia, to say that, well, no, that's one way to look at it. But another way is to look at the amount of time it takes to generate that object. So maybe you could have a small program, two equal size programs, and one has to run for a lot longer to generate, an object. And that's a good way to think about the complexity of it. So I guess we could say, how many DJs out there have logical depth? some of them do. I actually have enjoyed, a few gigs in town recently by fellow named Pena, who used to be with Antibellis and now is doing DJ sets that are composed of the actual live tracks that he's playing over a little bit. I'm drawing a little bit of a blank now on the project name, which is crazy, but Akote sound system, his DJ persona. And Akote Soul Sound is the band, who happens to be one of my favorite sort of Afro-Latin groove bands in Austin now. And I actually play quite a few of their tracks in the last year or so when I'm DJing.
What's the relationship between what you play as a DJ and what you play as jazz? Do they influence each other?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, I will tend to do a couple of different kinds of gigs because I have a lot of, connections in the nonprofit world, and a lot of events that I will do will be things that are kind of mixers, or at least the first part of the evening is a mixer. And I play a lot of jazz in that kind of context, sort of both traditional jazz, some of which can be pretty adventurous and some of which can be kind of loungy. And then I'll play things that are like jazz remixes and this kind of new jazz, stuff that has a kind of heavy electronic component that could have only been done, with Pro Tools or something like that. I really like this guy's Jazzanova. That's a kind of production DJ producer collective in Germany that kind of hit, I think, maybe around 1999 or 2000. And I would say those guys, they've got the logical depth thing going on. And, you know, they have similar tastes where they're starting with a lot of kind of Brazilian beats, you know, Afro-Brazilian and kind of old groove jazz is the sort of foundation. And then they kind of up the level of electronics. I mean, I actually told a few of my friends back around the time that I first got into that stuff in 2000 or so that I thought that in a way, you know, maybe jazz is sort of stagnated in the U.S. and this sort of thing that was going on, this kind of hybrid jazz electronics, was maybe the new wave, like, of innovation. I'm not sure if I would still stick with that statement. I was in a record store in New Orleans, not a record store, but a bookstore, I think, in New Orleans that had a big jazz section. And actually, there's a book on my shelf a few feet away saying, "Is jazz dead or is it just moved to a new location?" And this guy was, I'll have to grab it to tell you the author's name, Stuart Nicholson from the UK, I guess. And he actually, you know, kind of took the same position and said, yeah, a lot of what's going on that's interesting these days is in the realm of sort of electronic hybrids and then just sort of the kind of fusion of some sort of local cultural tendency, mostly like Scandinavian ECM kind of jazz. And I think, you know, there's something to be said for that. I have to look a little bit hard to sort of figure out, like, what's the real new thing in jazz in America. Although there is, there's at least one record that attracted me last year that was done in America that's called Spectral Jazz. And it's been this kind of spectral movement in contemporary concert or classical music for a while that, you know, finally somebody picked up on it and says, I'll try to kind of bring that in and make it the basis of my jazz harmony and maybe a little bit of the sort of unrolling structure of a piece. So.
Is there a relationship to, well, you have an interest in like chaos theory, nonlinear dynamics. Does that have any impact on your approach to music?
Yeah, I would say it absolutely does. And it was a really very conscious, I think, in a kind of jazz collective performance. And actually, at the time, I don't think too many people were thinking about that. But there's a fellow who I'll have to go, you know, do a Google search to look it up. But somebody wrote a book within the last 5 years that I actually read some time ago who was promoting that idea, you know, just generally that the right way to think about free jazz performance was really drawing a lot on this idea of complex systems theory, maybe not chaos theory per se, but the kind of networks that I worked with were called, you know, high dimensional chaotic networks. And what you would find in such a network is if you let every one of these, you know, individual oscillators, each one of which is putting out a stream, and you could think of that stream as being a dimension. So let's say that you set those all up running independently and they're all chaotic. Well, maybe that's not so fun to listen to. If you connect them together, it tends to sort of rein in the chaos and approach, you know, what you might call a coherence. And if you connect them really strongly, they'll no longer be chaotic and in fact can just turn into a periodic oscillator, which in musical terms would be a trill.
You know, huh. So that would be more harmonious.
Yeah, more harmonious. I actually did a little bit of work in about 1993 where I did produce some music, you know, using those kind of principles. And people had done, you know, fractal algorithmic music with what we would call, you know, low dimensional chaos, which is all that most people have ever heard about. So if you've just got one of these oscillators that's putting out a stream that can be, you know, random, apparently random, but, you know, there are ways to sort of understand that it's deterministic chaos by looking at it. Or it could be on the so-called edge of chaos. So that had all been done, maybe even in the late 80s, I guess. People were doing this kind of fractal music. And I was probably the first, and as far as I know, the only person that ever did anything where you know, did these, like, coupled together chaotic oscillators. I suspect other people have done it by now, but I'm just not really aware of it.
It almost sounds like Miles Davis's response to bebop, right?
Remind me of that one.
Well, you know, bebop was sort of chaotic, and Miles wanted to do a cool jazz. He played harmonies. He played, not always. I mean, obviously, he went through Bitches Brew, and his music grew interestingly, cacophonic at times, but early on, he drifted away from the bebop scene and started playing what I think he called cool jazz, which was, you know, the birth of the cool was the birth of this sort of very melodious and harmonic kind of jazz that he played in the 50s.
Yeah. Now, things at that time had not really gotten, in the 60s, when you had the kind of energy music, free jazz, where really people were just kind of blowing very wildly. Maybe like these first, I would say there was never anything, you know, even the first Ornette Coleman free jazz record, if you listen to that, it's people are definitely listening to each other. You know, they're not really playing independently. But some of the stuff that would come along later in this kind of energy music school, which I, you know, I have to say it's sort of more fun to do it than to to listen to it. That really, I think, hits the, you know, approaches that description of kind of uncoupled chaos. So anyway, I think I just wanted to come back and say when I did that stuff, you know, some algorithmic music using that approach, I did take it into the you know, electronic music seminar run at the university here by Russell Pinkston and let people hear that. And I think those people had been exposed to, you know, the kind of other fractal music or cellular automata music that was around. And they did say, you know, this is actually pretty impressive, and we have a little bit of a hard time believing that it was algorithmically generated, because there just seems to be something that's a little bit, it's kind of got a little bit more of that, you know, something that's hard to describe, but a kind of coherence. And one of the things that I was doing was also adjusting the phrasing a little bit, the timing, I think mainly the timing and not the dynamics so much, based on this evolving number streams. And it turns out, I don't know if you're familiar, John, with this researcher Manfred Kleins, who I would consider to be, you know, maybe the great music theorist of the last half of the 20th century. And he wrote several papers and finally has some lectures up on YouTube from Harvard a year or two back, I think. Anyway, he's done a lot of remarkable things, but for me, one that's very interesting is to look at, you know, how the time, the adjustment, the very small adjustments of timing in mostly classical music is his focus, really are crucial to expressing the meaning of the music or clarifying it. And he actually, with some help from a couple of people, you know, operationalized that into a software program called Superconductor that would take, you know, MIDI files of your music that you produced, or he kind of sold it with a lot of classical pieces built in. And they would analyze, you know, the music so that rather than sort of giving you the kind of rigid timing that if you've ever heard, you know, a MIDI piece that someone didn't spend hours and hours and hours tweaking, it sounds very robotic and mechanical and lacking in emotion. So what they did is would have a few knobs that you could use to adjust how the timing and dynamics and articulation, you know, vibrato, increases in volume, these kind of things would be adjusted on the basis of the sort of the melodic contour that was coming in. They actually would, you know, sort of synthesize the string music on the fly with a kind of built-in synthesizer. And it was actually quite convincing. I mean, even though people would hear about this and say, you know, you have to show me. I think anyone that would hear it would go, you know, Manfred, you're really on to something here. And I think additional kinds of things that he may have done since then is this idea about, you know, universality of emotional content in music. It's like, is it all culturally relative, or is there something something that is universal and people would agree on what emotion is being conveyed? Is you know, does everyone agree that this is a sad piece? So he was looking at that problem, which I'd say is pretty controversial and probably the mainstream in kind of anthropologically, politically correct kind of musical analysis these days would say, no, it's all culturally relative. And you're sort of taught this kind of thing within your culture. And what he was at least able to show was that if you give people the knobs to allow them to make these kind of changes that, you know, he felt express the emotion, people would all sort of converge on the same settings to say, like, here's a piece of music, make it more, you know, if you think it's sad, make it more sad. And that people tended to agree on, you know, what kinds of parameters would make a particular piece more sad. So I thought that was really, really getting somewhere. And I believe that he has also, you know, made these kind of demonstrations that people cross-culturally will identify, you know, at least, you know, for Western classical music, they can say what kind of emotion is being expressed there. And the way that they say it is by a kind of pushing on a small pressure sensor. So another part of his rap is that you're this kind of, there's a link between body expression and the conveyance of emotion that is really quite universal, that if you ask people to express, you know, abstractly ask them to express a range of emotions through pressure, that people will have a contour, you know, a readout that is quite similar cross-culturally.
I suppose that's relevant to dance, too. Dance as a movement expression in response to specific kinds of music.
So there was another researcher that when I was really, really immersed in this stuff in the early 90s, so I was quite interested in, you know, just being a musician and also somebody with a sort of budding interest in neuroscience. I was very interested in, did, you know, music and all kinds of expression give us any kind of unique insight into what's going on in the brain? And sort of, you know, how is it that various arts, you know, auditory and visual, do their magic on us? So there's a guy named Robert Armstrong, I think, that would talk about sculpture, and in particular, like in maybe in African arts, and one of the kind of, you know, deep truths or things that we would, you know, anyone would respond to is a kind of opening and closing of the body. So, you know, there's this sort of really basic, are you opening up, are you sort of extending your limbs, or are you sort of retracting? And I think that's something that you know, when you're dancing, you may or may not be doing that. If you see people doing that kind of thing, then you're probably perceiving them as a more expressive dancer. And if you're doing it yourself, you're probably giving yourself a little bit more of an emotional workout than if you're just, you know, standing in one place and doing the pogo, for example.
Well, it seems to me that music and dance and to some extent visual as well, to a very great extent, really visualization are all sort of manifestations of energy, right? So really it's about the way energy moves through us and takes shape in it, through culture and that sort of thing, isn't it?
I wouldn't really disagree with it, but, you know, the word energy is one that gets kind of batted around in a lot of contexts. And you know, for me, wearing my kind of a scientist or musical engineer hat, I would have to find a different way to say it that would be a little bit easier to, you know, turn into code or into the progress of a DJ set or something. So what would we say instead of energy? You know, it's just there are progressions. Oh, you know, here's an interesting thing that I wanted to talk about because, you know, we were briefly batting around the idea of me doing a an intro spot for the movie. Is this a little too incestuous to talk about?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So, you know, I thought about what I would do that would be both, you know, musically satisfying and would kind of also convey something about, you know, the ethos of Plutopia as I understood it. So when we were having that conversation and it was, you know, a kind of unity of pluralism, right? So I was thinking, well, what would maybe be kind of nice is to start out with a very unified, almost like a telegraph kind of sound where it would be, you know, one pitch and one rhythm. And then you would kind of start to complexify it by adding, you know, diverse rhythms and diverse pitches and maybe do what we would call a sort of polytonal, polyrhythmic thing. So that's, you know, there's probably some way to talk about that in terms of energy, but, you know, what I would think of it as is just sort of like opening it up, you know, adding a kind of more, it's really uncoupling. If you believe, and, you know, I kind of believe also that when you're creating music, when I'm playing, I think these kind of networks are probably what's going on, you know, inside my brain as I'm doing an improvisation or something. So if I'm being very, very straight and playing a theme and sticking to it, then I'm operating in a kind of low dimensional, very constrained way. If I want to let myself open up a little bit and kind of let the different sort of sub-networks inside of me uncouple a little bit, then it's going to be, you know, you're going to hear more tendencies operating at once.
The thing about not using the term energy is, and I was just kind of thinking about that, on the one hand, there's this sort of like, I was hearing something the other day where somebody was talking about everything being vibration, and somebody was being dismissive of this idea that everything is just some level of vibration, and matter is this level of vibration, and energy is that level, but it's all ultimately energy. And you can dismiss that, but on the other hand, that's sort of like Einstein's insight, isn't it? How do you reconcile all of that? I mean, on one hand, it sounds kind of woo-woo and nuts, and on the other hand, it's science.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, to me, the term energy, it has this kind of, you know, distinctive engineering sense. But of course, people use it all the time. And also vibration, as you say, I'm a little bit more open to using vibration, you know, sort of casually. But I also, you know, I really want to know, like, well, what does it mean if to say that, you know, people, two people walk into a room and you see like the vibration between them, or, you know, good, that person is giving off good vibes or not, you know. I always want to know, like, wow, what does that really mean? Does it mean that there's something that, in a sort of lost sense of, you know, detecting their pheromones or something like that, that, you know, you're conscious of at a certain level, but you really don't, you know, we don't really have the the easy means of expressing what's going on there.
I know, it's like with this, the whole idea of chi, you know, people swear that it's there. There's some form of energy that's subtle or that's maybe just completely embedded, so you can't really track it or separate it. But on the other hand, you know, science requires some kind of metric, and if it's something that you can't measure, what is it, you know?
Right.
What can you do with it?
Yeah, so, and I think that people should be able to measure these kind of things. And there are kind of descriptions. I mean, I've recently sort of dove back into neuroscience literature a little bit to see what's going on in the last, you know, 5 years or so. I was paying a little bit less attention. And the kind of area that I was working in, you would call something like, you know, spatiotemporal dynamics. And, you know, one of the kind of interesting experiences that I had when I was working on that stuff is I would do things like put particular geometric forms in a little matrix of a two-dimensional, you know, array of these chaotic oscillators. And I would essentially make the system breathe a little bit. So I would say, okay, you're going to start maybe less coupled, less chaotic, and then you're going to both uncouple and become more chaotic, and then you go through some cycles like that, and I would see sort of how these geometric forms evolved. And in particular, you know, one night I was using ellipses that had sort of golden ratio, you know, was the ratio of the major and minor axes. And one of the questions that I was interested in was, okay, there's a kind of myth or rumor in the, you know, arts culture that people really recognize the golden ratio. And, it, you know, is it true? Is it not true? And if it's true, what's the sort of underlying explanation for it? So you put this thing in the matrix and, you know, it's going to evolve and you get these kind of interpenetrating waveforms. And then I would do something that people would call a quench. So I would say, okay, it's chaotic. I really had this pretty noisy image on the screen. Now let me take away the chaos or really couple these things together. And what happens? Well, then you would wind up with these little patterns at the end that would maybe be at this sort of focal point of the ellipses. And this is maybe a kind of natural interaction when you've got some kind of vibratory or oscillatory system that is, you know, sort of putting out waves from each point, but also sort of responding to the wave fronts that are coming in from all the points around it. You're creating spatial structures and spatial-temporal structures where there are some sort of preferred points that pop out if you have some kind of rhythm in the control parameters of a system like this. So if I were trying to come up with, you know, explanations for like, well, why are there these points? You know, how do they actually control anything? You know, meridian points, something like that. This is the kind of language that I would be trying to use would be, you know, this language of both. We would really call it non-stationary systems. So in contrast to most of the early work with chaos theory or something, we'd say, here's some settings of this system. Let's just leave them set and, you know, think about what happens or observe what happens in a computer experiment. And let's come up with the most interesting static point, like the edge of chaos. That's really interesting. If all you have to live with is a stationary system, the edge of chaos is the most interesting thing. But I kind of immediately said, and I was sort of under the influence of one guy in neuroscience, in particular, Walter Freeman, who looked at breathing and the olfactory networks, and you know, right there you've sort of broken that assumption that the system is stationary. It's breathing in some sense. So you would say, if the more likely thing in biological systems is that, you know, non-stationary is the rule, because the only, you know, the main reason that people in engineering and science are working with stationary systems is they're easier to analyze. You might actually be able to solve those equations. Whereas when you have a system that is non-stationary, then it becomes more difficult to say rigorous things about it. So there's a little bit of an opposition between what actually happens in biology and, you know, where we're sort of driven by mathematical and scientific culture, I think.
It sounds like you're, to some extent, you're talking about, like, well, the networks that occur naturally or in biology or so forth are scale-free networks that have hubs and then nodes of activity. So maybe some of the points that you're talking about are hubs in some sense, that they have more connectivity than the less connected nodes in the network.
That's definitely possible, but with the kind of networks that I was working on, one thing that was kind of interesting is, you know, even though maybe you had a kind of static connections between the nodes, that their history and learning would wind up creating a kind of parallel network in the domain of states that this network was supporting, and which states were reachable and which states were connected to the other states. This is starting to get a little bit, you know, hard to talk about maybe without having a whiteboard or something.
But, yeah.
But yeah, this is, you can definitely think of things where there are centers in a network that kind of emerge in the, you know, we might almost want to call it like the life or the soul of the network. So it's not structural and it's not the parameters, but it's actually just states that are sort of more central to the network and have a lot of branches coming in and coming out. And that's something also that I think is not so well understood. I can kind of trace that to, you know, one paper by another guy who was very influential for me, a Japanese researcher, Kuni Kaneko.
What was that name again?
Kuni Kaneko, who was kind of the inventor of this mathematical formalism, coupled map lattices that I was using in my research, and some other people actually wound up using that eventually as a model of what we would call a sort of high-level neural network model, where each little piece is not to represent, say, a neuron, but representing a pool of maybe 10,000 neurons with a certain ratio. Great phrase from Eno. Certain excitatory-inhibitory ratio that would really allow, you know, this big group to act as a chaotic oscillator.
One of the things that I thought about a lot, and that I got some influence from Eno on this, is the sense that whatever is complex really is a manifestation of some simple set of rules, that really simplicity, there's a real simplicity at the core of all things.
Yeah, but I think let's don't go too far with it. I mean, it was, you know, another person in the science world that was promoting that same message was Stephen Wolfram, and his, you know, his books about, you know, a new kind of science, I guess, was his big manifesto that everyone waited a long time for that one to come out.
Yeah. He was looking for some kind of fundamental algorithm, sort of like the universal principle, I guess.
Yeah, universal principle. And but, you know, one of the things that I noticed, because I had already sort of made that leap into this assumption that you shouldn't be looking necessarily for one. Okay, if you start to open things up a little bit more in terms of, this, you know, one of the sort of dilemmas is, when you're looking at a network, or, you know, if you're looking at something in pretty deep in physics and, you know, sub particle mechanics, or something that's modeling a brain network, it's kind of maybe a little bit arbitrary to separate that into what's the state and what is the parameters, control parameters, what's the sort of structural underpinning that defines the network and what's connected to what, you know, so. But I guess the first point that I was alluding to was at least all of the work that he had done, you know, in that book was, again, with this idea of kind of fixed rules. So the rules did not tend to evolve over time. And I think that doesn't, it's not a very good reflection of what's going on, probably in something as complex as, you know, brain dynamics. But it might be the right rule for particle physics, which was where, you know, he was making more of an analogy, and I thought it was pretty a good analogy, and you could sort of understand something about how, you know, waves and particles were the same thing by looking at those kind of cellular automata systems that he gave as his examples of that.
Dave, I have heard a lot of different styles of DJ work, and some of it seems to be more about the technology, and the music is kind of an afterthought. And listening to your performances, it seems to be that music is the most important element with your considerable technical background. Is it a struggle to keep that balance?
No, but, you know, I do kind of make a point of ranging a little bit. Like, I will, even though I think that when I'm in my, you know, dance, I want to make you dance persona, what I'll tend to go for is something that has the kind of intensity of electronics, but also a kind of organic and very complex beat structure that's, you know, Afro-Brazilian music, generally based. But I'm also very willing and want to sort of always be conscious of that you don't really need that, and you can sort of drop back. And so I tend to mix in a lot of acoustic music as well.
And do you find that... Which approach seems to work the best with crowds? Do they go more for the techno stuff or the more organic music?
Well, I generally, you know, get pretty good feedback about the organic music. I've never heard anybody come up and say. I mean, particularly for me, it's that tends to be things that are like you know, 70s Brazilian funk and maybe similarly 70s Afrobeat or other kinds of you know, pretty grooving funk music. So it's and, you know, occasionally when I'm sort of playing for the home team, like I also have some involvement in the theater community in Austin, and have done some, you know, sort of shockingly eclectic DJ sets there, because I know that this is a crowd that appreciates all kinds of things, and I'll even throw in, you know, country music or just, you know, completely stripped down ethnomusicology kind of stuff, and I know people are going to be able to hang with it, and maybe they just need a little break anyway from the relentless pace of groove.
So it sounds like you're really conscious about striking a balance between just the raw technology and the musical content of whatever you do.
And yeah, but I mean, I do kind of consider myself as what I would think of as being a service DJ. So recently, I did some work with the folks at Real Women at their sort of holiday end of year party, and they said something like, "Hey, you know, we really don't want." I don't know exactly what their phrase was, but they kind of made it clear that they didn't want me to bring a big crowd of outsiders in there that were there because I was a celebrity DJ. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't think you have to worry about that because I'm not promoting myself very heavily." And I tend to think of it as this kind of service thing where let's think about this event. And, you know, if it's a dance party, then we'll definitely work it that way. If it's a meet and greet mixer, then I'm going to sort of retreat a little bit. And, you know, the things that are there, like if somebody happens to be taking a breath and listening to the music, then it should be very interesting. But, you know, we know how to bring it down to the background. But for me, you know, as a musician and somebody that experiences a lot of different ways of, you know, both as somebody who's on either side of, you know, the DJ booth or the dance floor, who plays in, you know, very structured, I'm working on somebody else's music as a sideman, or it's my own free jazz thing, or, you know, some of my most profound musical experiences have been, you know, just out in the field under the stars, playing with people around a fire, you know. So I like to visit all those kinds of dynamics and, you know, kind of have them all in the back of my mind, I guess. Whichever one I'm...
being a one-trick pony where, you know, regardless of the audience, you're only going to hear one approach. And, you seem to have a multitude of approaches, you know, in your bag of tricks, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if you were around when I did the Plutopia last year, I was kind of the interstitial DJ between the acts, and we had a theme that was music oriented, and I had sort of gone off and you know, found a lot of audio quotes from various you know, interesting musicians and composers, and I think I pulled some of that stuff in you know, as a kind of overlay. So I might pick an instrumental track and then you know, bring in Karlheinz Stockhausen over the top ranting about something, and you know, I think, yeah, that's I definitely try to sort of tailor what I do to the environment, and if there's a theme, you know, I can kind of think about how to work that.
What do you think about this year's theme, Future of Play? How are you going to respond to that?
Oh gosh, yeah. I think, yeah, it's interesting, and I wish I had given it more thought. I know we're really only a week and a half away, but I think I have, I had one idea about, you know, what I was going to do. I was actually thinking about reviving something that we did at the Maker Faire, which you may recall that I did a kind of installation piece where there were some sensors and you could kind of hand wave and essentially reorganize a painting on the screen that was mainly static, but had like one little area where it was sort of vibrating and nervous in the center. And then if you played around with it, that area would kind of expand and you could interact with it and kind of do like a dance with it. I mean, I think where we're at right now in terms of the flow is that I'm going to, again, be a kind of interstitial DJ video guy in the room where some other stuff is going on. So I'm still kind of assessing my options for exactly how that theme is going to play in. Yeah, I do actually have some interesting new synthesis tech to show off in some context that might come out that night that relates to some of the you know, the algorithmic stuff that we've talked about in this conversation. But it's, you know, it's pretty subtle, and it's the kind of thing where unless you came up and looked at what's happening on the screen, maybe you wouldn't know. You would just kind of go, you know, this really sounds pretty pretty interesting and not exactly like anything I've heard before.
The Future of Play has been an interesting theme to work with, and it's kind of interesting what Eric has done with it. I mean, what Derek has done with it. I haven't completely grasped exactly how the synthesis of all of these pieces is going to work out, but it's sort of fascinating to imagine, you know, sort of this coupling of something like Text of Light, which is sort of avant-garde play of sound and images, with some of the other pieces that we have that are like, you know, Bodytronics, Intimate Stranger, and so forth. But Text of Light in particular, I made me think about you because I've seen you do so much with the combination of sound and visualization. Are you going to be doing that much at the event, or even at the party on the 10th?
Yeah, so the combination of sound and visualization is something that I have worked with primarily in this software system called Anodyne that is it's a bit of an old system that runs on the classic mode of the Macs, which isn't really supported with all the new machines. So I have to say recently I've kind of buried what's going on there is still audio driven, but to be able to, I've kind of, you know, made a little break with the past and the DJ software that I'm using, and that software was not really ever intended so much as live performance on the audio side, although it does. So what would sort of work best but isn't, you know, technically possible would be for me to be piping the audio into it. And, you know, it might be that if I would spend a lot of, the usual effort that I could make that happen. But I think the short answer is probably there's going to be audio driven video, but the audio is not what you'll be hearing. and you know, sometimes I'll just as most so-called VJs do, I can kind of get in there and, you know, manually make it sync to the beat if that's what I'm in the mood to do. But I think, you know, it sort of gets down to, as somebody who spends, you know, relatively part of my total energy and time on this stuff, it's I'm willing at this point to let the video kind of run at a different rate. Like the video is kind of the slow wave, and the audio is the fast wave. And this is another another kind of element of my way of thinking about everything is, got all these sort of like multiple frequencies that are running together, and like, what do they mean? What do they do? Is one connected to the other? But it's kind of opening up another big topic that I could ramble on for hours about. But
maybe that's a good segue into talking about the Image Improv Orchestra.
Oh yeah. Well, that's I guess that's what I've got going on now in terms of the future of play, and something that I've promoted a little bit, and it's something which one of the things that a lot of people have done in sort of real time net art or something is soliciting user content, you know, on the fly and then doing something with it. What that project was about, and I'm hoping to revive it again this summer at a festival called Mass. It's this music and something art symposium, I think. Perhaps not coincidentally produced by Aaron Mass of Church of the Friendly Ghost. So we, a couple of years ago in the first edition of this, I guess I must have proposed this system, and it was project where I solicited people to contribute images that they considered musical in some way, or that would be effective as an object for improvisers to use as a musical score. So I did a lecture, I guess maybe about an hour of PowerPoint, that was an introduction to this idea of, you know, graphical, non-traditional scores and, you know, what people had done in kind of contemporary music and improv community. And then I kind of switched gears to talk about how vision scientists and visual psychologists understood images and how we, you know, break them apart into different frequency components, and then some of the natural ways that we're always turning the visual scene that we're looking at or piece of art into a time structure. And I think the most obvious thing that, you know, everybody realizes is going on is that if you look at a painting or a photograph, your eyes range around that. And probably you've seen some of these psychological demonstrations of eye movements on a painting something are pretty easy to find on the web. And that was another topic that I had kind of studied and worked with back in the earlier mid-90s and you know, done a little bit of computer modeling with. So, of course, I knew about it. And I said, well, you know, what one of the things that you can do is just sort of understanding that that's something that's implied in an image. And, you know, you can kind of break this image into a time structure where here's a sort of interesting zone of the image, and you're naturally, your eyes are going to be attracted to it. You're going to spend more time there. So why don't you just try to let your eyes kind of help you think about it. And as you're improvising, you know, you sort of use that as a guide. And okay, you probably would just spend, you know, 5 seconds looking at this image, but let's say you're going to do a 5-minute improvisation. Well, just kind of allow yourself to get stuck and sort of meditate on the local structure of the image there and use it in some ways to drive your improvisation. And, you know, I gave some examples, like here's an image and let me, you know, do an improvisation based on this principle. And after this lecture, we had a break and came back in and people had, you know, given me some images. Many of them were there in the audience. I think only one of the people that brought in graphics was willing to also serve as an improviser. I brought a bag of small instruments and, you know, had a couple of other folks like Jonathan Horn, an excellent guitarist that is pretty versatile, but I think of as being a kind of noisy free jazz guy. And we had a couple of musicians and whoever else wanted to join in that would perform the images that were projected on the screen. And we would tend to have a little bit of a chalk talk, you know, every time that we would put one up there, you know, and, you know, since I'd already given the lecture, I wanted to invite other people to think about it, you know, and see whether they got some ideas. So I might just say, okay, here's the image. Anybody got any ideas about how we want to work with this, you know, and just let people make their suggestions. And a few of the images were actually, you know, not what I would have promoted as the most musical. They were a little bit, say, monochromatic or mono frequency or something, but they were, you know, they were interesting images, but they didn't really fit my, you know, preconceived notions of what was going to happen. And of course that was great, you know, it was much better that some surprises come in. So I think, you know, that's a little bit the, you know, in terms of the future of play, it's like we've got something where there's you know, there's some rules, there's some ideas floating around, there are people bringing contributions from, you know, one media into another. So I'm sort of liking this as an instance of the future of play.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real good sense of what play is about. You know, people sort of throwing things together. Improvisation is, to me, a very playful concept. And I think we're going to see a lot of improvisation on the scene at this particular event. But I think it's something that we all like to do, too. I have kind of one final question for you that sort of piqued my interest throughout this conversation here. And I had been looking at your vita and kind of reading your background before we got started and, you know, kind of noting the work that you actually do in your day-to-day at IBM, mm-hmm. Where you're working on VLSI design and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering how that connects with everything else. Does your work actually connect with all these other things, all these other projects that you're interested in and involved in?
Yeah, you know, I guess if there wasn't something there that I found kind of intriguing, I would probably figure out another way to go. But the work that I'm doing these days, and I'm actually a little bit more free to talk about it because it was just publicly announced at a conference last week. You know, involves, like, you know, one of the things about chip design that's always that works for somebody like me that likes to look at patterns is, hey, you're going to look at patterns. And I've been working maybe for about 10 years now, and there certainly weren't too many other people. I wouldn't really like to say that nobody else was doing it, but I do have a patent or two in this area of what we would call like data mining of chip layouts. So I kind of scan over millions of patterns, which are sometimes kind of structured, sometimes kind of random, and basically build a kind of a dictionary of patterns. And this was useful in the first case because we're trying to print those in a kind of photographic process. And so it's nice to basically say we're making a test library or a regression suite of patterns. So we essentially look at the whole universe and we say, you know, here's all the patterns and what's a sort of representative subset, because if we're going to run a test of some complicated software, then, well, let's just, you know, if it works on the representatives, then there's some really high chance that it's going to work and not have its performance degraded on the whole set. What I'm working on now is, so when we're imaging these patterns in the last two or three generations, we're doing what's called variously deep submicron or high K lithography. And what's happened now is that to make a particular pattern, let's say you wanted to image the English, you know, Times Roman, the shapes that you're actually going to put on the mask will look nothing like that. Their topology is different, and the light that you're hitting them with a laser that goes through a kind of fractal-looking mask, a kind of mandala. And what actually happens is you can think of this as kind of martial arts with light and diffraction. So all the things that I love, you know, like patterns, what happens to patterns when you have, you know, colliding wave fronts, and, you know, it's all kind of in there, although that is not, I'm a little less involved with the depths of the optics and electromagnetic simulation and this kind of thing, but I've mostly been sort of guiding this use of this data mining techniques and this, how it actually plays out with the optimizers. So I'm working on stuff that's, you know, still like the chips that this technology will be employed for are still like, you know, a few years out. But it's, yes, it's a little bit tough to describe, but definitely, you know, you got your patterns, you've got your strange vibrations, and
well, it's kind of mind-blowing to think about the millions of transistors like embedded on a specific chip and all the circuitry and logic there. I mean, how that's grown in scope and complexity since transistors first appeared and since the idea of creating like embedded systems like that first appeared.
Yeah. Oh, and it was so much easier. It's really hard now.
I'll bet.
And you know, nobody's quite sure, I think, how many generations of silicon are left, because it's really quite a, you know, high stakes situation here now. Like, you know, when do we really hit the end of the road in silicon as we've known it, and when do we have to sort of switch to do something else?
Well, silicon is what? It's made from sand, isn't it?
Yeah, ultimately, it's a sort of crystallized form of quartz. Yeah.
So there's more, right? We have enough for a few more years.
Yeah, we're not running out of the material. What we're running out of is the ability to, you know, predict and control it at ever smaller dimensions with respect to basically one of the things that happened here is they kind of hit some kind of bump in the ability to go to a higher wavelength laser. So the trick is, you know, how do you actually make shapes that are smaller than the photons that are exposing shapes? And a lot of tricks have been developed to do that. So the problem is the only thing that's really easy to do is to make straight lines.
I've never been completely clear how we can do so much at such a micro level. It seems to me that it would be very difficult to really do like meaningful pattern engineering when you get to these truly microscopic sizes. And people talk about molecular assemblers and that sort of thing,
right? Yeah.
Like in nanotechnology.
Yeah.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Well, we're hopeful that some of the kind of work that we're doing will be more generally applicable to other kinds of processes. Just this idea that whenever you're working on any kind of production process that has a lot of nonlinearities and different steps that kind of make the process very sensitive, and you want to be developing the process, this idea of kind of mining the realm of possibilities, or another, I think another one of my cloud tags that I threw out at you is orthogonality.
Yes.
So there are just sort of ways to explore the possibilities of a space and say, like to synthesize representative patterns. So that's something that I think, probably people are going to be doing with other kinds of, techniques other than optical lithography like we use today.
Well, that's probably something we should get in.
DJs in the future will be like really aware of this as well. It's like I think about sometimes doing just a set that's really maximum orthogonality principle or something like that, where I just kind of basically put my sickeningly diverse full iTunes playlist, on shuffle, and just see how long it takes for people's heads to explode, But we remember the Voyager disc that was sent out. Well, that was pretty eclectic. But it's like I would like to participate in a DJ challenge that would, kind of come up with the next Voyager disc, and it would be kind of interesting to say, like, well, if you had to pick one tune, kind of do it like as a binary progression. Like, if you could only pick one, what would you pick? You pick two, what would you pick? Four, eight.
Easy answer: Telephone by Lady Gaga.
Yeah. Well, I gotta say, I'll plug one of my other favorite live bands in Austin, which is Six Pack, SICK'S. I think those guys can probably, they could probably do a tune that is pretty much representative of all musical tendencies and, in 1 5-minute tune on their best nights.
What kind, are they a jazz band?
They're kind, they're kind of gypsy punk, jazz, Zappa, it's kind of, everything is in there, and they can pretty much mix and mash and blend it up. Almost in the old sort of John Zorn, channel switching method, but they managed to get a lot going on in one song and somehow have it all make sense. So they're a little bit crazy and eclectic, but they definitely span the subspaces of country, bluegrass, fiddle music, free jazz, punk rock. They're just one of those bands, They've got it all going on, and they're good players, and they're crazy and amusing. I don't think they play all that often because Mr. Sick plays in many other bands and projects. So, yeah, I think you'd enjoy those guys.
Absolutely. We'll track them down next time they're playing. Well, I think we have reached the
exhaustion point.
Well, I don't know. I was tempted to go into some of the conversations we had before about politics, but I think we really have more material than we can use here.
Yes, so yeah, and I have to think about that stuff some, but I would like to have another conversation and sort of explore some of these concepts like logical depth and orthogonality in terms of like a open source democracy and maybe kind of rethinking economics a little bit.
Yeah, we could have a whole series of conversations actually, and we should do that. And for something like open source democracy, we might be able to bring in some other folks like, Are You Serious? Contacted me and kind of wanted to revive the open source party idea that we had been talking about a few years ago, and wrote a piece for H Plus about that. And we've kind of been trying to instigate some interest in that. And at the same time, there have been, actually there's multiple groups that have been contacting me from this way and that who are, I guess through a kind of anxiety response to the way things are going in the world, the fact that it feels that there's some kind of incredible tension manifesting itself globally, yeah, and a fear and concern that things are melting down, and people are starting to play with some interestingly radical solutions, just thoughts about that, and about how to create some kind of meaningful and sustainable future at a point where hope is a scarce commodity at the moment.
Sounds like we may have a ideal subject for some future programs, many future programs.
Absolutely. So, David, we'd love for you to join us on a regular basis if you'd like.
Okay, John, thanks.
Okay, well, thanks, Scoop, and thanks, David. This has been a great conversation. We're looking forward to the next one. So, for Plutopia News Network and 20 Minutes into the Future, this is John Lebkowski signing off. Scoop?
Thank you, David, and we look forward to the next encounter. It hopefully will be as enlightening as this one.